Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
Good day, everyone. Welcome back to the ATL Podcast. I am your host, Mappy Davis, and today's guest, you may know him as DJ Smurf. You also may know him as Mr. Collie Park. He came here to the Pittsburgh Yards, which is my new recording studio, home away from home. He joined me on the porch outside. It was a nice day, and we had a great chat. I got to tell you in advance, this is one of those situations where the host apologizes for some technical difficulties. Now, I hate to do that. It's a tale as old as time in the podcast game, but the rest of this podcast, the content of this conversation, what we got into is so good, there was no way I was going to scrap it or try to recreate it, so you just got to hang in there. There's a somewhat underwater-ish sound to some of my questions, but just hang in there because his answers are fantastic. You will learn a lot. We will get inside the mind of someone that makes some of the most popular tunes that have ever been created. Whistle While You Twerk, Crank That, Wobble, Miss New Booty, Whisper Song. It goes on and on. We are talking about songs that you are going to hear, I think, to the end of time, and certainly at wedding receptions and parties and everything else. So he came over here, and we had a great chat, and I'm going to get it to you right now. Away we go.
All right. Well, listen, we're going to get into you, and I'm excited to have this conversation with you. First of all, we're the same age.
Okay.
It's nice having people with like a similar sensibility.
Right.
And like you've dealt with money people.
Right.
You've sat in rooms.
Right.
With, let's just say, older white people with money.
Right. and what I can say is scared money don't make no money. So the people
she went in confident. You're saying.
The people came at me confident. The people, when people want you and they know what they want, they don't have a problem spending the money because they'd rather spend it and lose than to miss the opportunity.
No, but you make it sound so simple.
It is when you got money.
But I'm saying from the artist or from the creator sense, who are dying to get that money from whoever it is, the film studio, the label, you know what I'm saying?
Okay. So when you saying, what's their attitude going into that room?
I'm saying, you're a guy that's I'm guessing figured that out a few times.
Well, luckily for me, I've always created a demand for myself. Like before internet, before social media, before all of that. So when you start, when you build your stuff from the ground up, and then you can pick that up and take it to somebody, or they come to you. Like, look, we see what you're doing. We want to be in business with you. You had an advantage in that potential relationship. But if you going to them like, yo, please, I got this idea. Oh, man, you just give me the money and I can show you. You had a, you know, that's a harder sell. That's a harder sell.
All right. Well, so let's back up a little bit. You went to high school where?
I went to high school, College Park, Fellwood High before it became Banneker High.
Before it became Banneker
yeah.
High?
Yeah, before okay. That.
Because I've spoken to a few Banneker graduates.
Yeah, so I was before that. So, but I was there when it became Banneker. Okay. So I was there. When did it become Banneker? 89? So, yeah.
So, you're the class of 90.
91.
91, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
What do your friends call you?
How they know me?
Yeah.
I've developed friendships throughout my life. So, if you know me as Mike, which is what I was born as, you call me Mike.
Right.
Only one person calls me Michael.
Is it your mom?
No, my mom calls me Mike. Okay. My fiance calls me Mike, okay. Michael. My friends that know me from mostly, you know, Smurf, as far as my industry and people who I met like that. So Smurf, Collie Park is very industry.
So only those in the industry call you Collie
nah,
Park?
Nah. And I can say I have friends that call me Collie Park that I met in the industry, but that was so far down in my journey that I had a whole career before getting to that point. You know what I mean? So those are newer relationships and friendships.
All right. So I was watching this clip of you earlier, and you were talking about MC Shadi.
Okay.
So you worked, was he the first like dude that you like worked, and how did that happen?
Well, I was in a DJ crew called the J Team, the east side of Atlanta, Decatur. And he was affiliated with that DJ crew. You know, it was an east side thing. I was freezing
this morning.
Yeah, man. So, man.
We're out here on the porch of Pittsburgh, y'all.
Feels great out here.
Now it feels great.
Yeah. Actually, I'm about to get hot in my short sleeve shirt.
That's what I'm saying.
In a minute.
It's toasty.
So, you know, we had mutual. I was in the DJ crew that he was affiliated with before I became a member of the DJ crew called the J Team. And at that time, he was working with, he started out with DJ Man. I'm just a huge fan of Shadi at this point. He started out with DJ Man. And then he went on and got DJ Toomp. Everybody knows who Toomp is. And Mike Fresh. Two other DJs. So that was his second set of DJs. So then they stopped working together. And that's when he came to the DJ crew looking for a new DJ. And they recommended me to him. And that's how I met him.
And how old were you then?
Maybe 17.
And what were you listening to?
Like, all Booty Shake.
All
Two
Booty
Live
Shake.
Crew, that kind of shit. You had to force East Coast shit on me. But the good East Coast shit, it wasn't all good back then. Like some of this shit we listen to now and it's classic. To me, because I'm so South, I couldn't listen to it. But anything with a good beat, like You're a Customer, everybody, we played that. I'm just giving you examples. Anything with a beat from the East Coast, I could listen to. Like all the Bridge Is Over, that kind of shit had a little 808 in it, stuff like that we could listen to. But I'm listening to mostly Down South. Luke Skywalker Records, Vision Records, Foresight Records. These are labels on South Florida.
So not LL, not Grandmaster Flash, none of that stuff.
Well, no, I was. Those were the mainstream artists.
Right.
But in the 80s, late 80s, you had a lot of that stuff coming out, man. And where I can appreciate it now, I couldn't back then. That's what I'm saying. I was so South. I couldn't listen to that shit.
So you didn't like the breaks?
Or even even some of the bigger... So, take Run DMC, for example. I gravitated toward the records that they had that had 808 in them. Like, records called, like, Daryl and Joe. It was an album cut on, I think it was the King of Rock or Raising Hate. I can't remember which one of those albums. But Peter Piper hit with us down here because it had the 808 drums. So the East Coast records that had the 808 drums... I gravitated to all the other stuff. It grew on me.
So was it just too slow? The other stuff?
No, because honestly, everything was so new in those early days, right? So now before we called it subgenres of hip hop, like Miami bass, it was just music. It was just records. I think they communicated to us better than the records from the East Coast. Because you got to think, when the West Coast... You know, pop, when the East Coast popped, for a lot of the audience, that was our first exposure to them. Because we weren't jumping on planes and going to New York and jumping on planes and going to L.A. and even jumping on planes and going to Miami.
Right.
We connected with these people through the music. So I just think even from a subject matter, them talking about the wolf is in the back of the car and shit like that, we could relate to because that's what we were doing.
Right.
They weren't talking about that shit in the East Coast rap or hip hop.
But this whole what they called the Miami bass sound,
mm-hmm.
like all of that, nobody talks about that when you talk about Atlanta. It starts with Goody Mob. You know what I mean? Like that's where they think it starts.
To me, that's one of the biggest injustices of anybody who quote unquote tells the history of, you know, the hip hop scene. I hate the fact that Luke Skywalker is not considered the godfather of Southern rap. Labels, you know, he was, to my knowledge, the first person that I looked up to that was on my radar that had a label, did tours, distribution, all that shit. And he's never mentioned. He's like, you know, when they think of Miami now, they thinking of Khaled, and which I don't have a problem with it. But when you go to telling the story, you got to start with Luke. Now, those guys from down there, they'll give him respect. But it's like when I think VH1 came here and did an Atlanta thing, and I wasn't in it. And my friends got mad, but I didn't. And maybe I should have. Because if we don't tell these stories, they won't get told, and it'll just be forgotten. Well,
then let's talk about that. That's like one of the reasons why you're here.
Okay.
Because I feel like, you know, once upon a time, there was – so I grew up, and I'm only hearing like the mainstream stuff.
Right.
Right. So you have to imagine me in – I mean
– Where are you from, though?
So I grew up in Marietta.
Okay. So you're from here?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, I was born in Boston, but I grew up in Cobb County. Okay. Right? We did not come to the city.
Okay.
Unless you were going to a concert at the Omni.
Right.
And it was lock your doors. You're going to the Omni.
Right.
Right.
Right. No doubt. No, let's keep it real.
I've talked about on the show a few times how people who live in Atlanta now don't understand it was not a melting pot.
Right.
We lived in the burbs. Y'all live down here. We didn't fucking mix.
Well, even with me growing up on the South Side in College Park / Union City, I wasn't in the city of Atlanta. Often until I got older. But in my day-to-day, you know, I met a girl later on in 11th, 12th grade. That's when I started going in the city. But before that, if I wasn't in the DJ crew, even on the east side of Atlanta, I had no reason to go over there other than to talent shows and shit like that, but not to just on a daily basis to kick it.
Right.
We didn't have cars. We didn't have – all we had was Marta.
Right.
So that's how we got around back then. So, yeah.
So I grew up – I had three older sisters and – in my house, it was a lot of, you know, rock, right?
Right.
So you're coming out of the 70s of like Led Zeppelin and The Who. And then on the radio at the time, if you look at popular radio in the 80s at the time, you know, there's, what is there? Like maybe Michael Jackson or Bruce Springsteen and that stuff. So then.
Which was a great time, man.
No, it's a great
time. When I think back now, that how we just listen to everything, man. And I guess it's a kind of like that now because when my daughter gets in the car with me, she's 17. Just turned 18, she'll go down the dial and be playing shit I ain't never heard of. But it's a variety of music, but it's just different to me the way that we just ingested everything back then.
Yeah, if you look, it's a much more diverse, like top 40, if you will.
Okay.
So then I go to my friend's house for a birthday party and he has Houdini Escape.
Okay, okay.
And my mind is blown.
Who had 808 drums? Friends was 808 drums.
Friends, Freaks Come Out at Night.
Yep, right? That was 808 drums.
5 Minutes of Funk. Still one of my favorite songs of all time.
Yep.
I try to teach my son that one. And like my mind was, you know, what is this?
Right.
I played it at my house, like in my room. My mother was like, what is this noise?
Right.
Right. So then you start hearing the more popular things of the time. But then the history just gets told.
I'm going to turn my turn it down.
The history that gets told is, you know, there's these guys in the park in New York and they do their thing and then Run DMC comes along and then boom, then a few years later, the West Coast start like that. Everything just gets just these big giant headlines.
Right.
And then they kind of skip to, oh, in Atlanta, by the way, there was this basement where these guys, right?
Right.
But Shadi gets skipped right over.
Right. Right.
So why don't you talk about kind of that time if we're looking at what – so you graduated in 91.
Yeah. And I actually remember seeing Shadi before I got to work with him. I was at the Fox, and they had a concert, and it was Rakim, LL, the first time I had seen Public Enemy on stage. And I don't even know if I had heard of them, but they were on stage when I walked in. And that shit fucking
– Yeah.
I might as well have been a white kid from the suburbs because – when I walked in and they had the S1Ws, you know, stepping and shit, and they had the shit, and I walked in like, what the fuck is going on? So that was the show, and I remember after the show, we were outside standing on the side of the street, and Shadi pulled up in a Cadillac, and I want to say he had a fucking cell phone, one of them old like when cell phones and he just pulled up, and that was my first time seeing a rap superstar up close. And in person, I was just like, my jaw dropped. So that's what Shadi was for me. You know what I mean? Like the first, even though he wasn't, Mojo was the first guy who's on wax here. But Shadi was the first rapper who was, even though he was born in New York, we always considered him from Atlanta, but he was the first one that left 285 with his music. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because how he found Luke Skywalker to even get signed back then anyway is amazing, you know. But then when you look at the kind of music that he made, it just had a little more appeal than everybody else's. And even when I started DJing with him, we were in Texas, we were in California, we were in Louisiana, we were in South Florida, like, because Shake It was his biggest record, which right. I didn't know at the time. I liked the hood shit that he had, the Gotta Be Tough and the Pink Panther. No, he was getting booked for Shake It, which made me look at, that was the beginning of me looking at how music worked.
Shake It was on the radio.
Right. But I hated it. I didn't hate it. I knew that was before I even knew to call it commercial, I knew it was a commercial record for him. And I knew that was a record that probably was bigger than other, without even knowing it. You just know in my mind, I would have said this is some bullshit. I just call it some bullshit. I get it. It worked. But no, I like the Rap Will Never Die and the Bust This and all that shit. But when I started DJing for him, I was like, oh shit, he going to California. He going to Mexico. He going to Texas. And back then in the early 90s for me, who had never, I was born in Orlando, Florida. So that was my thing, back and forth to Orlando. That was pretty much my thing. And when I started traveling on the road with him, I got to go places very early and get exposed to how people consume music other than what I thought was the shit, you know.
And at that time, did you think, you said like Luke has this model of not just a singer or not just a DJ, but like producer owns the label. Is that where your mind was going?
No, not even. We didn't know none of this shit was possible. You know what I mean? I was just a kid DJing on a DJ crew when I got a call like, yo, Shadi looking for a DJ. So that's how it started for me. It wasn't like I was DJing like, yo, one day I'm going to be on the damn stage. I'm going to be in New York in front of everybody. That just wasn't a reality for me. So it's just like a kid in the basement breakdancing. You know, he don't think that shit going to take him, you know what I mean, to the 50 year anniversary of hip hop. If you wind up on that stage and you were part of the first breakdancing crew in New York back then, that ain't what you were thinking when you started. So that's what I'm saying. In my wildest dreams, even when I go into my studio now and I see all the plaques on the wall, it's very humbling because you never thought that would be you with a plaque. One plaque would have been enough. I could have quit. Give me a plaque.
What was the first one?
It was one that I really didn't earn, and it's at my mom's house to this day. I gave it to my mom. It was for the So-So Def Bass All-Stars album with My Boo. And the reason why I say I didn't earn it is because they approached us. I was working with Shadi at the time to put a record on the album. And I didn't want to be a part of my ego. I was on some, I don't know these guys on this album. You know, this finna be some commercial knockoff shit. So all we did a skit on the album and that shit wound up going gold. So I got a plaque.
You keep saying commercial like it's a dirty word.
Back then it was to me. Oh, I'm the grimy. As far as what this culture is to me, back then I was so closed-minded, but and the art form meant everything to me. So if I didn't respect you as an artist, I couldn't work with you because I came from the mixtapes, the guys who actually, we were the radio for this music down here before we had 97.5, now 107.9. We were before all that shit. So I was a part of that. So I was the authentic shit. I was the gateway to the Dope Boys. So I had integrity. So if I didn't respect what you was doing, and that was the first time I saw that was some stupid shit. I say all that to say, I realized how dumb that train of thought was when I got that plaque and I felt like I didn't earn it.
Well, this is another conversation that came up recently, this concept of what the sellout used to be, right? So you and I grew up in a time where, like, so let's say for that time, late 80s, early 90s, like U2 and Bruce Springsteen, like they will never fucking do a beer commercial. If they did, then forget it.
Okay.
Right? Like that's never going to happen. Mm-hmm. That's the true artist.
Right.
Right. And, you know, a pop band might do it. And I feel like now it's almost the opposite. You can come out in a commercial.
Everything is opposite now.
Right. And this idea of, and again, I feel like it's a young man's thing to say, like to point a finger, it's like, well, you're a sellout because I liked you when you were small and you were just this band that me and my friends liked. And, you know, again, pre-internet, pre-social.
Right.
If you met the other kid that like wore the Houdini t-shirt to school, you were best friends. Right? Or yeah. like on my side, like Elvis Costello, like he wasn't on the radio. So if I found a kid to listen to Elvis Costello, we were going to be best friends, right? Okay. So you have been a part of and produced some rather large commercial worldwide
but his,
sensations.
It's funny. I was in the studio last week and we in here cutting a record. Of course, it has some racy lyrics to it or whatever. But while they're writing the record, they start talking about radio versions. I said, I don't give a fuck about a radio version. We finish the song, and then when we get done, then we worry about what the clean version. I never made none of my records to be big. Never. I never went in the studio and said, we about to make this number one a big. No, we just went in there and jammed out. That's it. And it just connected. It just connected with people. But that comes from, to me, we approached it from an art form, though. Like, we approached it from a music place, not from anything else. It wasn't influenced by... Because first of all, we didn't know that it would be exposed to a large group of people. Take Whistle While You Twerk, for example. You listen to the lyrics of that record, literally talking about strip clubs inside of 285. We literally thought that record wouldn't leave outside of 285. But we said we're going to make the best strip club record for Atlanta that we can make. When you listen to the lyrics, they literally calling out strip clubs in Atlanta. Next thing you know, I'm looking at the sound scan. They in L.A. buying this shit. We jumped over the whole country and got a fan base in L.A. They connected with it.
How was that? So what year is that? 08?
99.
Oh, 99. Way back. So how was that even possible?
2000. 99. Honestly, I don't know. Back then, the way we worked, because we weren't on radio, the record pools were big for us back then. So we would surface record pools all over the country, which would, you know, street DJs, radio DJs, all the DJs. So you had to have a record that walked. So we knew our music had to walk. Like, you give it to somebody and walk away. Or somebody else, you might not even meet the DJ who playing your record. But I was taught, you got to get them in the first 10 seconds. You got like 10 seconds on pushing play on something before somebody got it. So I think our music was good enough to catch people quick. And I think you don't know who's going to gravitate to you. Look at Wobble. This shit flopped. Who knew it was going to be you think we were thinking about weddings and shit like that when we was in the studio making that? No. You just don't know.
See, this is what. So I was thinking about that too. So, like, if you would put Wobble in the same lineage as Electric Slide, mm-hmm. Macarena, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
However, I feel like maybe I'm wrong, or maybe you can't answer it because you're too close to it. But I feel like those are like joke songs, like. Especially Macarena, like everybody kind of knows the Macarena's bullshit.
Right.
But the Wobble's not bullshit.
Well, it was never meant to be a line dance. It was not a line dance when we made the record.
Well, I don't think any of those guys meant to, did they?
Well, I think the Electric Slide. I don't know about the Macarena. I don't know. I can't speak for that. But all I know is for us, the Wobble was just one big jam session. So you feel the musicianship and the artistry within that record. And thank God somebody in the Midwest put a dance. That's all I can say. But
so you don't even know who?
I can say this. When we finished the album, we went up to when we went out to LA and played the album for the label who we were partnered with, Warner Brothers. We had another record coming out after Get Silly, which was the song for Vic that popped. And we had a follow-up record that kind of sounded like Get Silly that we were thinking about going with. We played Wobble for the staff immediately. That's what they wanted. And the staff at Warner Brothers, when they heard the album, they heard Wobble, because we would have never, I ain't gonna lie, I would have never put that record, but they were so adamant. They were so adamant of
why would you have never put that song out?
Because you gotta think, we coming off of Soulja Boy. I'm coming from Soulja Boy into Vic, who's coming off a Soulja Boy-ish single.
Right.
We rolling. So why switch? But I'm no dummy. I told you, I learned my lesson in the beginning of being stubborn and being stupid. And to be honest with you, the staff at the label were all white. It blew my mind that this record, which didn't have a dance at the time, it was just a good-ass song to them. And we were about to go and put another, you know, Get Silly-ish on the song out. But
right.
Then after we left that meeting, we was like, fuck that. Because it's not like we didn't like Wobble. It was like, we going to put this record out. It flopped. Got him dropped from the label. And 2 years later, two, 3 years later, the dance popped up, and the rest is history.
So it was released, and DJs in the radio didn't want to play it, thought it was stupid.
No. It's funny, because I was cleaning up some shit, and I forgot we had sheet music as a promo item that we had the sheet music because the horns and stuff on the record. So I don't know what we did with the sheet music. We just had a bunch of sheet music. I don't know if we went and gave it to the high schools or whatever we did with it, but I ran across that. For whatever reason.
Let's speculate. Because it's the kind of song that, I don't know, if you're in your car and listening to it, doesn't really do much, but like if somebody plays it, if they're at an event, it just has a different feel.
Well, even I would, now it does, but back then there was nothing that it sounded like. When we tried to put it out, there was nothing on the radio, nothing in the streets. It sounded like nothing. So I never forget, I had a lot of people think that we were going for a go-go feel because of the percussions in the record. And then you have people, I never forget the first time I went to New Orleans and heard it down Bourbon. I knew it was this was after it was popular, but I didn't know that it was popular like that. It was a Mardi Gras with it. I was walking down Bourbon and everybody was playing that shit, but it's because of the horn instrumentation. So I just think people just like good music at the end of the day. Some shit just good, man. That's one of them records it's just a good record.
Well, I feel like there's this, you and I could have this entire conversation for however many hours called What is a Hit? And people say, well, you know it when you hear it.
Sometimes, a lot of times.
But everybody is trying to do, it's what you have done, it feels like, at least, like you said, like once they like to have a, you know what I mean?
Right.
Some, you know, thing that everybody was talking about and everybody was doing, even if it was for a season
right.
or a year.
Right.
And so you seem to have figured out something, and I want to know if you have any idea what that is.
No, I don't. Honestly, I even when I'm out and I hear these records out now, I just have to, I thank God. I'm like, yo, how did I come up with that? Like, where did that come from? Like, I could be somewhere and I hear Trap Star, Young Jeezy, and it's like, wow. And I actually played everything on that record. Where did that come from? I don't know, but I'm at my best, honestly. I'm at my best when I'm not trying to do anything in particular. I'm just in the studio, and I'll go on these tears to where I might, for 2 weeks, something inspires me. Like, I went on a tear, a partner, a bunch of old records, and I don't sample. Like, so I just went, and for 2 weeks, I bought one of these new digital turntables, because back then I still had the old turntables that couldn't hook them up to the computer. I didn't know how to do it, so I went and bought one of them with USB turntables, and for like 2 weeks, I just got fucked up at the house and sampled a bunch of shit and just made a bunch of beats for nothing, for no reason. Now, within that batch of beats, there's something special in there. But when I go in the studio with somebody who's looking for, that's when the magic don't happen.
Right.
Even Wobble. Wobble, and I keep going back to these records. Wobble came, the way Wobble was made, that was what, 07, 08? That was 08. So I was in the studio with an R&B group and I was bored. We was getting ready to leave. I had my headphones on and I told I sequenced that in my keyboard, which I normally don't do. All I had was my keyboard, my motif, and I just sat there and I beat out the drums to Wobble while they was talking in the studio. I just had my headphones on and I beat out the drum. Man, I'm over there not paying no attention to nobody, just vibing. And after I got through, I said, before I go, I told the engineer, I said, man, bounce this down for me. He bounced it down.
What does that mean?
Copied the tracks into the computer. We was Pro Tools at the time. So I said, bounce it down. We tracked it out and it was on my hard drive. And there it sat. I forgot all about it. My brother, who works with me, is good for going through my hard drive and finding shit for the artists that we're working with. So he took the drums off. All it was the percussion and the 808 and the hi-hat and the claps. That's all it was. And he found it. And that's what started Wobble.
And then you're with a particular artist. You say, how do you feel about this one? And they start going.
Well, for me, I won't play. See, for me, I won't even play that kind of shit. My brother will play it. Or they'll stumble up. If I just made a bunch of beats, if I did a beat CD or something, and I just threw it, I say, it can't hurt to put this shit on there, but I don't think they're going to pick this. Even back to Trap Star, I didn't think Jeezy was going to pick that beat, because I had some more shit on the beat CD that I did that I thought he would have picked based off what I thought he was looking for.
So was before all, I want to back up a little bit, was before all this, before all this?
Wait was 05.
Right. Was that the first one?
That was the first, that was the transformation. Yeah, that record right there.
So who said, what if we just whisper this whole fucking thing?
I did.
No one had done that.
Nope. Not to my knowledge.
No. I mean, I guess you could Google it. Maybe people have done it in the middle, but nobody said, what if we just whisper the whole thing like we're whispering to the girls in here?
Right.
So you said to them, why don't you try this?
Yep. And we weren't even in the studio. They hadn't even heard the beat. I was telling them about the beat. We were in New York doing something, and we were standing outside of a restaurant waiting on our car. And I was telling them about the beat. And I don't know if they came with the lyric first, or I said, let's whisper the shit. I don't remember how that happened. But when I heard the combination of them whispering, wait till you see my dick, that was like the most... I can't even say I thought it was genius at that time. I just thought it was funny as shit. Just... You in the club and you lean over to a girl and you say, wait till you see my dick. That shit is fucking genius, man. It's genius now. So, but if you'd have asked me, that record got leaked. I would have never put that record out as a single. I would have put it on the album, but I wouldn't have put that out as no single. So it got leaked. And the response that people had to that record was so, you know, the rest is history. And the only reason why that record didn't go bigger than it did, the first batch of research at radio came back very bad, which is where they do call out. And they, you know, it just researched horribly on radio. So back then, and still now, we were damn near number one. When that research came back, all the stations just started dropping the record. Just started dropping. But the streets didn't. Yeah.
So it sounds like you had this idea. You once had this idea that if I'm loved by the streets, I don't care about anybody else. And now that's not really where it's at.
I think because I come from being a DJ, because at the time I wasn't even looking at it as the quote unquote streets. I come from mixtape DJing, right? So the younger I am, the closer I am to what's really going on. Cause I'm the DJ playing the shit that's popping. You know what I mean? So
it's immediate.
Right.
You don't have to wait for the feedback.
Right. Right. So all my records, I'm trying to get the response that the records that I get play that I didn't make. So I have inside trader information, if you will. So when I'm making these records, man, I'm just in my mind for whatever purpose, the gumbo in me, he was born in Orlando, he was raised in College Park. He was a DJ for Shadi. All of these things that are part of my history, even being able to travel outside to like the Cali and Texas and to see other people. The fact that when I went to college, I was my freshman year, the whole floor that I was on was Northerners and Midwesterners, New York, Detroit, Chicago. That was all that was up there in a senior dorm, and I'm a freshman. So all of these things shaped the way, because they would come to my room. I was selling mixtapes, you know, trying to ask me, why you ain't playing this Tupac? I remember somebody asked me about Tupac. Man, Tupac was garbage to me back then. Until he made the Me Against the World album, I thought Tupac was garbage because I couldn't get the beats. It was just a bunch of noise to me. But when he made that doom, 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 so many tears, I was sold because it had that drop in it. So I will always stay true to what I do, no matter what influence, you know. Take the halftime record that the Saints play every time they score that I did for Yin Yang, which is a HBCU inspired band record. Up under all of those horns and congas and all that
Wait,
shit.
Man, you're gonna write a song. You're gonna be an Atlanta man. You're gonna write a song
for
the Saints.
We didn't do it for them. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Oh, they took it off. They
found it and they. The owner's daughter wanted to play it at the game. And when she did, the rest is history. So fast forward to it's in a MasterCard commercial now.
What song is it?
Halftime. Stand up and get crunk.
Can you play it?
Yeah, yeah.
Will this give you a few cents if I play it right now?
Go ahead. Yeah.
I have no idea how the music business works.
You can get it for free, man. That's it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Ba-da. Yeah. So they call you or your manager and say, we want to play this in the stadium.
Well, no, they don't call us to play it in the stadium. They call us to put it in the commercial.
But when they start, so if they want to play it in the thing, that's just part of the whatever, ASPCA, whatever.
Yeah, they deal. But if they want to actually use the record for something, that's when they got to come to us.
Right.
And, you know, we'll say, yeah, I'll never say no. I don't turn down no money.
So you don't care what commercial, what company. There's no company you would not do business with.
Well, there's always a line, but it would have to be something that you'd be like, okay, I see why you wouldn't do that. But for the most part, nah, it's just art. You know, why would I say no? I would say it's free money, but it's not free money because, you know, we worked hard on that music. I have a lot of songs that we still license for a lot of stuff.
Are you in a bunch of video games?
Not a bunch. That song is actually in a early Madden. That song right there did a few video games. I can't remember what they are right now. But no, we do mostly television and movies.
All right, so let's talk about Soulja Boy, which was the one that was the biggest one after Whisper, right? Was that the next big one?
Mm-hmm.
So that whole genre, mm-hmm. if you will, do you feel responsible for it?
I feel like I'm a part of it. I won't say responsible. I was the platform for it, you know, because I gave Soulja a platform to present what he had to the world, you know. And so in that respect, yeah. But from a creative perspective, that was him. I was just like I'm the coach. I'm, you know, and you can have Patrick Mahomes, but with a bad coach. He's not Patrick Mahomes that goes to five conference finals.
Right. And Brady needs Belichick.
Right. So I'm Belichick.
And you said Soulja Boy should have been on stage the other night.
Right.
Because how do we justify sticking him in amongst, I don't know how many other artists in 50 years of rap music?
How do you not? How do you not? So this is why I said that. And I have no complaints on how they did it, by the way. That was just my humble opinion. If you read what I wrote, my humble opinion, he should have been there, because if you're going to go all the way from where hip hop came from to where it is, when you put Lil Baby on stage, that's when I say, who's responsible for where music is right now? More than any other artist in music, who ushered in everything that we know about how to sell, market, produce, everything about music, who ushered that in? Soulja. We were the first to sell 3 million singles on Apple, which you just pulled the song up on. So we were a lot of firsts on where music is today, not where it came from. So when you start saying, where are we today? I don't know how you can't. He's more responsible than any other artist for where music is today. From how we sell, not how we sell it, but how we market it, how we sign artists. Nobody was going on the internet to look for fucking artists before Soulja. I made sure we put that in the music video, though, because that's how it really happened. Fast forward to the day, that's the business.
You sent him an email and said,
I hit him on his two-way. But that's the
business. RIP two-way pagers.
Right. That's the
people
business.
Listening, young people listening have no idea what a two-way pager is.
Google it. I swear to come up. But you got to think, that's the business model today. What we did is responsible for how music business is done today. That's why he got to be on that stage. If regardless of we can get from a creative or whatever, that's null and void to me when you start saying, because a partner of mine argued with me saying, you know, because it's the Grammys, they looking at it on a more artistic. I said, well, you know, no disrespect, but if you got Lil Baby up there, you're not, that don't go. So, which Lil Baby is up there to represent now. I get that. But how did we get there? From where Soulja is, which was now, that was 07. It's 2023. That's a big gap of influence. So that's why you got to put him on that stage. You got to. The whole TikTok dance shit. What do you think? What was the dance that put this whole shit on the map? Crank that Soulja Boy.
Well, you had to have seen that Atlanta episode, right?
Which Atlanta episode?
The Crank That Killer episode.
Atlanta. Oh, yeah.
You had to have seen that episode,
yeah.
Sir.
Yeah. I stumbled up on it because nobody told me about
nobody
it.
Nobody texted you?
No. I stumbled
Soulja
on it.
Soulja didn't tell you?
No. I haven't spoken to Soulja in years, man. But I did stumble up on it.
So, I mean, they're clowning on a little, but not really.
Well,
I guess that's kind of my question is that there's definitely people who want to clown on that whole on Fabo and all that stuff.
Well, I look at a lot of the stuff that we did that in the moment wasn't a part of the cool table at the lunchroom. But my catalog has aged very well. So you might have artists that might get more critical acclaim than College Park. But every party, every mix show, we have records that's going to be a part of every currently. You got to run through something that came through College Park. Now, a lot of artists can't say that. Artists that you deem up here, way up here, you might hear a record from this guy every once in a while currently. And they can tour. Their brand might be bigger. But the impact musically on the culture, ain't too many people really impacted the culture more than we have. Even my smaller records, Walk Around the Club, Fuck Everybody. That record still gets played.
Well, again, I feel like you kind of figured it out because you're proud of that, you know your legacy, and you can walk around like a normal person.
Yeah.
Right?
That's the most beautiful part about
right?
it.
That lady didn't know who you were.
Right. Right. I feel like
that's perfect.
That's actually a blessing. Because I never not want to be able to go. I love walking around the grocery store.
Right.
If I can't walk around the grocery store, I'd be miserable, man. Who wants to go? And it's funny. Every time I think I should cover up or whatever, I say, so many people, I don't feel like fucking with nobody today. Put my hat on, put my mask on. As soon as I step into the spot, they'd be like, oh, hey, Smurf, what's going on, man? I ain't seen you in a minute. You know, so. But no, man, that's the cool part. Because it really, I didn't get into it for that. The big stunt on folks and flex on folks and to have more money than this person and to drive the biggest car. I didn't get into it for that. When I'm somewhere and I see the response of the people when my music comes on, that's what I got into it for. That's the ultimate gratification for me.
So let's talk about what you're working on more recently. The most recent stuff.
We having fun right now. Yeah, we just having fun.
I mean, it appears that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how I say this with a straight face. Twerking at the hoedown. I mean, yeah. How do you even say it without saying twerking at the hoedown?
Right.
I mean,
right.
So now is this just like you just enjoy playing in this? Because I know there's another the one that's the favorite jeans one.
That comes out Friday.
That comes out. Get it on your pre-download now.
Right.
Are you just having fun kind of playing with this country rap genre? Like this just the mood you're in?
Yeah. Just because I feel like from where I come from in the hip hop community, I think they taking this shit too serious now. And they're not taking it serious enough. So when I was turned on to the country rap shit, I was exposed to a bunch of rappers who still take pride in the actual art form of rhyming, which blew my fucking mind. Like, yo, they really care about the quality of the content from the delivery of it to, and most of them sing like without auto-tune, which the song I'm about to put out got auto-tune on. It's just it's a throwback from the talent. And it's an older audience to country rap. And so I just said, a partner of mine who was, dabbling in it for a while had been trying to get me to do production for some the country rap artists. And I was like, man, I ain't fucking with no country rap, man. But then when I did it, I just had that twerking at the hold down song half-ass done, just laying around, and I sent it to him and said, what do you think about this? He was like, yeah, man, that's it. That's what I'm talking about. So we put it out. And now, what would be cool, though, would be able to find an artist that I could do a project on. That's the ultimate goal.
Like a whole album.
Yeah.
Not just...
Right, right.
I mean, how do you even measure success now? Because the way stuff is consumed, that's, radio almost doesn't matter.
Right.
You hit the right TikTok audience and forget it.
It's funny that you say that because when TikTok, I ain't gonna say when it blew up, but I had a record and I was like, let me see what this whole TikTok shit. And I you can run campaigns with TikTok. You can actually get with people who actually work TikTok, and we'll leave it at that. So I had this record, this artist that I had did. And I said, let me just to see what it is, let me just run this campaign. And I paid this guy to promote on TikTok. And at the very same time, Say Ayaya went viral on TikTok with nothing. It became one of the top five biggest songs on TikTok for that year, 2 years ago. So I'm sitting here looking at the record that I ran the campaign on, did little or nothing, and a song it was just in my catalog. And the kids found it, and they started making videos to it, and that shit went through the fucking roof. And so it's like now, you don't know what the fuck is going to catch. You don't know because... What we had to our advantage, the type of songs that we made back then, it wasn't everybody wasn't making them. Everybody wasn't making twerk record. Everybody wasn't bent over in the camera twerking. Now everybody's doing it. okay, so now you can't do that no more. So now, even with the record that I got now, I'm not making songs for girls to bend their ass over. I'm making a song for you to listen to. And that might be the first, this might be the first song that I intentionally made for you to listen to what's being said and just consume it and just enjoy it, not take it too serious.
My favorite jeans.
My favorite jeans. It's a breakup song. It's a breakup song. It's actually funny. It's a funny ass breakup song. So,
But that's back to the question. How do you define success? What will be success for you with this song?
I mean, if the shit, you can have monetary success, which if any of the other types of success happens, it's going to go back to money if you own your shit. So I own my shit. So there's just levels of there's levels of success. You know, for me at this point, if it introduced me into that world significantly, that's a win for me without even making a bunch of money off. Now, if it popped and went number one, that's self-explanatory. So right now, I'm not doing this particularly for the success of it. I'm doing it because I enjoy doing it.
And even when these songs do blow up, if the artist is out there performing it, you're not even there.
Well, the beautiful thing about streaming, and I do DJ, so that's kind of how...
You don't have to be there, though.
No. But that's cool, because, again, I if I own the record, then...
You own everything.
Yeah.
You're not you don't have a label deal that where you're beholden to...
Distribution.
That's it.
Partnership.
Did you ever... So you own all your masters since day one?
No. All these deals were different, but most of my deals were partnership deals, so I do okay.
I'm not trying to get into your wallet, into your checkbook.
It's all good.
I'm curious again because it's like to try to explain it to my kids now. It's so hard to explain. So you know my kids like so I have three kids and so like them and their friends even before TikTok these dances were taken off. Like what was like around the time of Soulja Boy? Like what was the damn other one? The
shit.
Break your leg.
Yeah, stanky leg.
Yeah. Stanky so leg. Like that, like I would have never heard that song, but right. My kids, that's all they, you know what I mean?
Right.
Or I'll be in the car and playing a song and they'll start singing. I'm like, how do you know that one? They're like, oh, that's in the video game I'm playing.
You don't know how they consuming this, which is, it's never been a better time for catalog. This is the greatest time in the world to have records that people from a nostalgic perspective want to go back and revisit. They don't have to get up and go to the record store to go buy it. All they got to do is this. And thankful for me, I have a lot of records that people remember where they were when they were out. You know what I mean? Like college days for most people, for my shit. Like, well, when we was in college, oh my God, that record right there. So I got a lot of that shit goes on.
Right.
So a lot of people still consume our old records. So right now it's a great time to have catalog that people, because streaming is up. You know, I hear artists complain about how much money they don't make. And it is fucked up to a certain degree. But when you have ownership and not an artist deal, it makes a big difference.
But most people are going to take the artist deal, especially when they're young, because they don't know any better. And
if you want to get out here and spend your own money and blow yourself up, then you ain't got to take the artist deal. So that's why they're going to take the deal, because they haven't put the work in. See, when you at the mercy of the label, if I come to you asking you for money, you ain't got no bargaining power. If you come to me trying to give me some money, then I can tell you what I want in exchange for your money. I don't want $100,000. Just give me $10,000 and I retain all this because I'm already rolling. I just need access to your Rolodex and your contacts. That's all you there for. I don't really need your money. Just provide me some services. And touch people who I can't touch. And I keep everything and give you a small percentage.
So who's the people you can't touch?
I mean, if you're a new artist, like if I'm trying to go to radio, if I'm trying to publicist and stuff like that, like things that the average person just don't know yet, you run into these same artists 2 years down the line, they'll be like, man, I don't know why I fucking did this. Hell, I met this motherfucker last year. I don't need them for that no more. Like, it's just, you're going to sacrifice when you first get into this business. Don't be scared. Don't be so scared. You're going to get fucked. Your first deal, you're going to get fucked. Whether it's on top of the table or up under the table, you going to get fucked because you have not built any equity into your deal. If you build equity into the deal, then you can dictate the deal. But if you just got a hot record and you might not have another one and timing is of the essence and somebody come and slap a bunch of money down and say, look, you got 6 more weeks on this song and it's going to be yesterday's news. What you want to do? you got a fucking decision to make. You could bet on yourself or you could take the check. That's just the game we play.
Did you see the Murder, Inc. documentary?
No, I didn't. I don't watch a lot of that kind of shit. Because for me, I lived my own version of this shit. So I don't watch a lot of that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, like Irv put it out himself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so he comes out as the hero in most of the story. I mean, mm-hmm. he talks about the stupid stuff that he did. But all those songs were big at the time. But the reason I'm asking you is because I look back and I don't think a lot of them are songs that are going to be timeless the way that we look at, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, but they're talking.
It's a lot of songs like that.
But they're talking about Ashanti and Ja Rule, like they're the greatest things in the world. And they did. They sold a shitload of records.
Right.
But I don't want to hear them today.
Right, right. Well, that goes to the point that I was trying to make. It's a lot of artists that might be bigger names and bigger brands, but their music not aging as well as our music.
Did you run across him in any of your dealings?
No. It's funny because he was on TVT where I did the Yin Yang deal before I got there. I don't know how long before I got there. So that might be the closest time that I passed across. But nah, we never worked. I did meet Irv right after we did the Whisper song, matter of fact, because the guy who's A&R over at TVT and Irv were like this. So we went by the studio. And I never forget. He's funny then, too. He said, boy, you're going to have to, he said, you're going to have to find a 100 more ways to do that bass. He said, because everybody finna want that shit now, that doom, doom, doom. I never forget that. That was some funny shit to me because that beat was so big at the time. And as a producer, he knows when people start coming, you got to feed it. And I don't even think I had the David Banner record out at that time. But yeah, he was like, you finna get a lot of offers for working. You have to figure out how to keep redoing that shit.
So how do you even decide who to work with? I assume people...
They usually come to you.
A lot, but I'm saying everybody probably comes to you. How do you decide who to work with? Like, even for these couple songs you got coming out.
Well no, those are, I'm just open to any of these country rappers. I'm just open. You know what I mean? The producer now is undervalued. You got a lot of, you got cats that's on the top of the food chain. But you can go on the internet and license a beat for $50.